Hi, everybody. My name is Bobby, and I'm an alcoholic. And thank you for asking me. It's an honor and a pleasure. And I love speaking because it makes me think about myself a lot. Yeah. It's one of my problems. My sobriety date is November 2nd, 1984, and my home group is White Oak, and we meet on Thursday night. And for 12 weeks, we usually talk about the 12 steps. And then for 4 weeks, we usually end up arguing about the 12 traditions. And White Oak's a little different. We have a cowbell there. And speak too long or off topic, they'll ring it. But the funny thing is, once we got the cowbell, people never got off topic anymore. We make a lot of fun of each other at White Oak. We tease each other a lot during the meeting. Some people call it crosstalk. We basically call it sarcasm and everything. And in the big book, there's a line that says, "We alcoholics are sensitive people. It takes some of us a long time to overcome that handicap. Well, if you come to White Oak, we'll help you overcome that handicap." I come from an Irish Catholic background. My father died at 59. He died of a heart attack. He also had cirrhosis of the liver through malnutrition. Uncle Buddy died at 55. He had a heart attack also, and he died of he also had cirrhosis of the liver through malnutrition. They all like to drink a lot. Uncle Charlie, he died at 42. I don't know what killed Uncle Charlie. He just, he was the alcoholic you saw on TV. You know, he was always shaking and having trouble. And I knew growing up that he was an alcoholic. And I asked Uncle Charlie one time why he drank so much. He says, made him feel good. You know, and that's why he drank. And he just couldn't stop. He was in and out of St. Elizabeth's a lot. You know, and eventually he died at 42. I don't know what killed him. You know, I was pretty young at the time. But basically, everybody said it was from drinking. Aunt Mary died at 48. Her liver stopped working, and she drowned in her own fluids. And Aunt Mary was the only member of the family I know that drank wine. You know, and so that's sort of my family background. None of them made me drink. None of them made me drink, you know. And what happened to me is, I guess when I was about 14 years old, I mean, I've sipped my father's beer a few times when I was real young and everything, and it didn't really do anything to me. When I was 14 or 15, I used to play a lot of ball in the area, and I was a rather good baseball player. And I was playing with people a lot older than I was. And, of course, I always felt like the little kid. I had a reputation growing up. My mother would always say he was a shy kid. You know, I always felt uncomfortable around a lot of people and everything, and so I'm playing ball with these guys a lot older than me, and I just felt out of place. I could play as well as they could, to be honest, but I just felt out of place. And after the game, they would open up a cooler and everybody drink a beer or two. And, of course, I drink a beer, and for some reason, when I drank that beer with them, I felt like I was in place with them. I felt like starting to fit in. And so after every game, we'd sit and drink a few beers. And, you know, in the hot summer, beer started tasting good playing ball, and I start requiring a taste for alcohol or for beer, basically. And that's when I was 14, 15 years old. When I was 16, I discovered that the shyness I had would go away if I drank. Yeah. So I started drinking a little more with some guys, got in some trouble a few times. Nothing really serious, you know. But one thing I noticed when I was 16 and 17 years old, I started having a capacity for alcohol that the other boys didn't have. For some reason, it seemed like I could drink a lot more before I got real stupid, you know. For some reason, I seemed to have a bigger capacity. And at 18, given my age, you could drink in the district. And we used to go down every night. And a place called Charlie's. There's two places down the district, Charlie's and Sparky's. Sparky's is where all the kids went and made a lot of fun and got in a lot of trouble. Charlie's was an older group. I went down to Charlie's because they were down there to drink. And I enjoyed drinking. I didn't have too many ill effects. I never really had that hangover I hear people talk about at the time. For some reason, it just seemed like my capacity to drink got greater and greater. Yeah. I started drinking a little bit of whiskey here and there, but that was just mainly a phlegm, just a thought. There wasn't no great need for alcohol because I was always drinking beer. Yeah. I started working for Giant Food. It's a grocery supermarket up where I live. Oh, and I started working for them. I met some guys. After work, we went and got a few beers, and I went with them. And again, I noticed I could drink a little more than they did. Back then, Vietnam was going on, and I got drafted into the Army, you know. So I went down to Fort Bragg, North Carolina, you know, learned to talk a little slower. And down Fort Bragg, during basic training, you know, it was kind of crazy then. They were just getting people in and out as fast as they could. And it wasn't a whole lot of discipline. Because we used to sneak off during basic training and go someplace to get something to drink, you know. And it was cheap to drink down there. In fact, so I was sneaking off, got caught a few times. I was E3 twice in basic training. They give you stripes while you're moving up, just before I got out. And I got to E3, and I got down to E1, and then I got to E3 again, and I got down to E1 again. Basically for, you know, not coming back when I was supposed to. I got a 3-day pass, and it was good for, I think, I forget the mileage, but like 300 miles from the base, and Washington, D.C. happened to be 350, and I went back to D.C., and I came back 2 days late, drunk as a skunk, you know, and they got all excited, and they made me an E1 again, and that was it. Took a little bit of money from me, but no big deal. And like for some reason, I could drink a lot, and every once in a while I'd get drunk, but the next morning I woke up, I felt fine. I didn't have that hangover. My mouth got a little dry, and then someone suggested drink what you drank the night before, and it took care of the dry mouth, you know. I found that, in fact, I love morning drinking. I love when someone talks about drinking in the morning. That was my favorite time. In the D.C. area, we have a place called TikTok. It's a Maryland National Landmark. It's a bar that's been around for a long time. It opens up at 8 o'clock in the morning, and you go down there, you wait in line patiently. And when you go into TikTok at 8 o'clock in the morning, nobody's trying to be your friend. Everybody's nice and quiet, waiting to have a few drinks. Around 10:30 or so, place start livening up, you know. But I never thought I had much of a problem with alcohol because I could drink so much, you know. I just had no trouble drinking. I had a friend of mine, we used to call him Two Beer Joey. He'd drink two beers, act all stupid. We figured he was the alcoholic because he couldn't drink at all. So Joey stopped, you know, and we just figured that was smart on his part, you know. But we just didn't seem to have much problem with alcohol. And when I got out of service, I went back to Giant Food, and I was doing real well with Giant, never missed any time. I was getting drunk a lot, but never missed any time. I became Giant at the time. With Giant Food, I became the youngest produce manager. And then a couple years later, I became the youngest assistant manager. I was up on the co-managers program. And as time went on, I went from co-manager to assistant to produce to clerk again. But getting there took a little bit of time, you know. And luckily with Giant, they transfer you to different stores. The better you are, the bigger the stores you get and everything like that. And if you're a troublemaker, you get transferred a lot. Well, with Giant Food, I probably worked in about 55 different Giants, you know. Half of them was because I was good, and the other half was because I was drunk most of the time. And I made a lot of friends, and that really protected me. I got that warning one more time, and it's it. Yeah, I got that a lot. But I never really thought I had a real problem with alcohol. And deep in the back of my mind, I knew if it got bad enough, I could quit. I believed that. If it got bad enough, I could quit. And so I just kept going on working for Giant. I was getting promoted at the time and met this girl I thought I fell in love with, you know. And we happy as could be, and everything went fine. And finally, my drinking started getting in problems with the relationship. And you know, she gave me the solution to my problem. She said, don't drink so much. You know, this girl's intelligent. You know, but for some reason that didn't work. Then she turned to me and gave me another answer to my problem. Don't drink at all. And when she told me that, I figured I'd stop drinking. Well, for some reason I picked up a drink and I started drinking again. You know, so eventually I got rid of her. You know, her alcohol out, there's no choice. You know, and that's how I, you know, started drinking. I started experiencing blackouts and drinking. You know, drink got worse and worse. Funny things happened. My favorite blackout, I was playing in the Montgomery County Touch Football League. And after the game, it was in the spring league, so it was a warm day, and we all went over to our house, started drinking. And the people next door had a swimming pool, and they were out of town, so we decided to go swimming. And this is about 6 o'clock in the evening. And the last thing I remember is taking off my clothes and climbing the fence to go into the swimming pool. Well, around 5 o'clock that morning, next morning, I'm in my car driving home in the nude. I got my wallet and my car keys, but nothing else. And at the time, I was living in this place, beautiful place called Northwest Park. It's probably the cheapest apartments in that area, you know. And I remember going down to my apartment looking for a place to park. Well, this is one of these apartment complexes that had 500 units and 5 parking spaces. So there's no place to park near where I live. So I'm parked about 150, 200 feet from the entrance of where I have to go in at. And I'm sitting in the car, and the sun's coming up, and lights are going on, people going to work, and I'm sitting in the car in the nude waiting to get in. And, of course, the longer I sat there, the more lights went on, the higher the sun got and everything. So I finally got out of the car and walked briskly to my apartment. And funny thing is, first thing I did, I went in and got something to drink. And I kind of laughed about it, you know. Didn't think much about that, you know. And like I say, in the back of my mind, if it got bad enough, I could quit. I honestly believe that. I started having some medical problems, you know. I went with a friend. We went down to Nag's Head, North Carolina, to do some deep sea fishing. And basically all we did was deep sea drinking. And we were down there for a week, and my gums, I went on a binge for a week, and my gums were bleeding, and my tongue was starting to split. And I come back, and I go to this doctor, and he asked me, he told me I drank too much. Don't drink so much. You know, and he gave me something to take, and of course they said don't take with alcohol, and so that didn't make any difference, because right after I left the doctor's, I went and got something to drink. You know, it just made sense to get something to drink. All the people I knew drank like I did, pretty much. You know, the people I hung around with. I started drinking a little more whiskey. I fell in love with this thing called Windsor Canadian. A real smooth blending whiskey, and that was nice. I used to drink that a lot. Start messing a little bit with gin. I worked at Giant Food, so I could get all the lemons and limes I wanted. Didn't know what I was doing with them. You know, I started drinking gin, you know. And I started getting drunk a little more often. But for some reason, I had this capacity, you know. And I wake up in the morning, I'd have that dry mouth. And I found out I didn't have to get a TikTok at 8 o'clock in the morning. I'd keep something at home to drink. Yeah. And I'd start drinking a little bit in the morning and get rid of that dry feeling. That I start feeling on edge a lot, you know. I start shaking a little bit in the morning, too. I'd wake up and start shaking a little bit, and I knew how to get rid of the shakes. Drink something. And it worked. I'd get rid of the shakes. I'd go on to work. I felt like everything else in life was pretty normal. I just drank a lot. I knew that. I never thought of myself as an alcoholic, you know. But the shakes start showing up after about 4 or 5 hours without drinking. If I'd go about 4 or 5 hours without a drink, I'd start to shake a little bit, you know. And I'd take a drink and the shakes would go away. You know. I found also sleeping. I never slept more than 4 or 5 hours. I'd wake up, you know. Twice in my apartment, I fell asleep with my clothes on. And that was lucky because I left these things on in the kitchen that caught on fire. You know, so when the fires broke out, I was already dressed, ready to go out, you know. Next door neighbor cut the screen and got me out, you know. And I just, what happened, I decided to fix something to eat, I think, I don't remember. And I go in the bedroom, I laid down with my clothes on and fall asleep, and things would catch on fire. You know? And my solution to that is, don't cook while you're drinking, you know. Don't cook while you're drinking. Because I honestly thought I really didn't have a problem with alcohol. Or I knew I could drink a lot. I had a great capacity for alcohol. In the back of my mind, I knew if I had to, I could quit drinking. And that was important. It's something I just couldn't let go of. I just knew if I had to quit drinking, I could. You know. And finally, it got to the point where I went to this doctor. I was having all types of problems. I was bleeding in the mouth, my gums. I was shaking. I had some liver problems. My blood work came off crazy, and doctor said, you have to quit drinking. And when he told me that, I made up my mind I wasn't going to drink anymore. And I walked out the doctor's office, got in my car, and on the way home, I stopped at the Wheaton Tavern. That was my home bar, the Wheaton Tavern. And I walked in the Wheaton Tavern and started drinking. And for some reason, from the doctor's office to the Wheaton Tavern, I forgot what I decided to do. I forgot that I was not going to drink anymore. You know? So the next day I wake up, I go, oh, I messed up. I won't drink again. I just won't drink today. And that night I went out and got drunk, you know. And for about 5 years I decided not to drink. And I mean, I meant it. And for 5 years my mind would change. And that's the only way I can say it. My mind would change. For some reason, I'd pick up a drink, you know. and I don't know why. And there was no fight. It wasn't like I was fighting myself or anything. It just, my mind would change, and I'd pick up a drink. And one thing I noticed, well, I didn't notice then, but I know now, once I pick up a drink, I don't stop. Yeah. I just don't stop. I just keep drinking. Yeah. I start, in this 5-year period, I started getting away from beer, started drinking a lot more gin and Windsor Canadian. Yeah. And I just started, for Giant Food, I had the biggest reputation as the biggest drunk they had for a while, you know. But I made a lot of friends, so they kept moving me to different stores, you know. But for 5 years, I thought I could quit drinking, you know. I've been arrested a few times. I got arrested for being drunk in public, drunk and driving, and drunk with the intent to get drunker, you know. And no big thing, you know. It's funny. The first time I got arrested and got locked up, I was all embarrassed. After that, it became old hat. It just didn't seem to bother me. Yeah. And I just couldn't stop. Well, what happened to me is I got arrested for at 12 noon, driving home from the Super Bowl pub on my way down to Eddie Leonard's where I get some whiskey to drink. And I got pulled over by the Montgomery County. And I got arrested for drunk driving, and it was 12 noon. I blew a 2-0, and I was on my way to do some drinking that night. Day, and I got locked up and went through all the rigmarole and everything like that. And finally, I guess I was released around 6 o'clock that afternoon, and called up the bartender for the Wheaton Tavern and asked him to come get me. He's gotten me out of jail before. He's a good friend of mine. He picked me up, and the first thing I said when I got out is, "You have anything to drink?" And he said, "No." So he took me back to my apartment, and I went upstairs. I had nothing in the apartment to drink, which is really unusual for me. I didn't know you could drink vanilla until I came here. You know, I had nothing to drink, and I'm getting a little shaky now, a little on edge, and I go up to my next-door neighbor and ask if he had anything to drink. I was out. And I didn't have a car at that time because it was still impounded, so I had to find somewhere to get something to drink, and he gave me a beer, a Heineken. That's the last thing I drank was a Heineken. I didn't know it at the time. And that night, I had a roommate at the time, and I said, "Look, when you go out drinking, wake me up. I'm going to take a nap. I'm going to go out with you." And he didn't wake me up. And I fell asleep. And for the first time in my life, I slept more than 4 hours. I probably fell asleep around 7 o'clock at night, and I woke up at 5 o'clock in the morning, I believe. And when I woke up, I was feeling sorry for myself, and I was shaking, and I started crying. You know, I had a lot of problems. I knew I had DWI. I was getting ready to get fired at work. And I just felt terrible, on edge. I didn't have a hangover, but I just felt really bad. And I remember I said, this is before cable TV. I said, thank God I can turn on the TV and watch cartoons to get my mind off this stuff. Yeah. And when I turned on the TV, there was Dr. Kennedy. He's a Presbyterian minister. And he said, through the power of prayer, you can have anything. And I remember reaching across going, bull crap, changing the set. And when I changed it, there was good old Jerry Falwell. And old Jerry said, through the power of prayer, you can have anything. And I turned off the set, I started crying again. And I got on my knees and I asked God to stop me from drinking. And it wasn't out of any great faith, it was just out of desperation. And I asked God to stop me from drinking. Something happened to me that night, that morning when I did that. I felt something press on my shoulders and then release. And I felt light and I felt good, you know. Something happened to me. I believe something happened to me, you know. And I felt great. And I was shaking, but I didn't want to drink at that time. And I had the shakes and everything. I felt on edge. And it's, you know, so at 10 o'clock that morning, I had a friend pick me up and I went to the Super Bowl pub. Oh, I'm sorry. I went to the Wheaton Tavern. And Bobby, the guy who gets me out of jail all the time, was there. And I said, Bobby, I'm not drinking anymore. You know, and Bobby's heard me say this before. Last time Bobby heard me say this, he said, Bobby, I'm on the wagon. I'm not drinking anymore. Give me a cup of coffee. He said, we don't have coffee. I said, well, give me a Bud then. You know, but this time I went and said, Bobby, I'm not drinking anymore. You know, I've had it. I just can't, you know, I don't want to drink anymore. But this is all the people I knew were at the Wheaton Tavern. All my friends and everything like that. And a lot of good people there too. And Bobby says, well, you ought to give Billy a call. And Billy used to be a drinking friend of mine. And 5 years ago, he quit drinking, so I stopped talking to him. You know, I had nothing in common. So Bobby calls up Billy, you know. And Billy says, well, come on over, and he's going to take me. He says, he wants to talk to me. And Billy's been in AA for 5 years. And I didn't know that. I just knew Billy stopped drinking. So I went over to Billy's house, and Billy sat me down, and he explained to me what an alcoholic was. And to be honest, I didn't know. I knew I couldn't stop drinking. You know, I knew I had the shakes and all types of problems from drinking. But I really didn't know what an alcoholic was, you know. And he told me that I have a disease of the body as well as the mind. You know. And that what happens, once I take a drink, I can't stop. You know, and I start looking at my history and I start making sense. You know. And he's told me about going to AA and how he went to AA and found a way not to drink. You know. And I'm willing to go because I want to stop. I got a lot of problems. At the time I can't stop myself. You know. You know, and he said, told me a lot of other things that were just over my head. Confused me. I didn't know. I just knew I wanted to stop. He did say one thing I'll never forget. He says, when it comes to alcohol, you're insane. Yeah. And I said, what do you mean insane? He says, well, how many times you decide not to drink it and you end up drinking it? You know, how many times you decide you're going to have one drink and you keep drinking it? He says, when it comes to alcohol, you're insane. You can't make a proper decision with it. You believe the lie that you control your drinking or whatever. You know. So Billy took me to an AA meeting. And I was lucky. I ran into people I knew that were new in AA. You know. And that was great. You know. And I started going to meetings. And I started getting confused when I went to meetings. You know. Because I was new. And I know what you're supposed to do when you're new. I sit in the back row like this. You know. I wanted not to drink. You know, but I'm very closed-minded. You know, and I wasn't open-minded to what was being said. And that was a problem. You know, I started meeting a lot of people. I started knowing the AA language. You know, I could turn it over and get to the other side like anybody else. It had no idea what I was talking about. You know, but I was sitting back there and I was going to meetings. You know, I even started making coffee. You know. And that was helpful. I got to know a lot of people. You know, and started making a lot of friends in AA. But after a while, I started going crazy inside. You know, I was having a hard time. I mean, I was looking at the steps and trying to understand what they meant. What was the hidden meaning in the steps and all this stuff. And I was just getting more and more confused. You know, I had the big book at home. You know, that was suggested reading. I heard. So that's what it was, suggested. You know, it holds coffee great. You put it right on top of it. Never been opened. You know. So I'm going along, and I'm starting going crazy. And Billy was my sponsor. He told me that he was my sponsor. And I didn't know you got to choose when I came in. You know. And Billy would talk to me about what's in the big book. And I'd listen and smile and sort of nod my head. And then go to meetings and then get confused about people sharing. I remember sitting back there, and one guy said, I drank because I was angry. Well, I ain't stupid. If you're angry, don't get angry. You won't drink. You know? That's how I looked at things, you know? And I started looking at myself, trying to figure out why I drank. And I wasted a lot of time doing that. You know? Why did I pick up the first drink, you know? And then when I took an inventory, I looked at myself. I took the first drink when I was in love and when I was out of love. When it was raining or when the sun shined. It didn't make any sense. I don't know why I took the first drink. Other than that idea that for some reason, when it comes to alcohol, I'm insane. You know? So what happened to me, I was going to a lot of meetings, making coffee, learning a lot of people, and going crazy inside. And I did this for 6 months. And about the end of 6 months, I knew I was going to drink again. I didn't want to, but I knew it was going to happen. And I didn't know what to do. So I went up to this old-timer named Ben. Ben had 31 years at the time. And I said, Ben, my program isn't working. I'm going to drink again. And old Ben started laughing and says, we ought to try our program. He said, our program was written in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Ben helped me a lot. When I first came in, I remember I had about 6 weeks. And I went to the step meeting. Billy took me to the step meeting, and Ben asked me to lead the meeting. It was on the 10th step. I said, wait a minute, Ben. I only got 6 weeks. I knew nothing about the 10th step. And Ben goes, whoa. I didn't ask you to speak. All I asked you to do is read the preamble, read the step, point your finger. I got 31 years. I didn't come here to listen to you. Yeah. So Ben told me it was in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I went home that night, and I had that big book that I've never used. And I picked it up, and I tried to figure out where 6 months was in the big book. You know? And when I opened it up, where I thought 6 months would be in the big book, there's a line in there that says, a spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. You know, and it didn't suggest it. So I start thinking about things, you know, and by going to a lot of meetings, I start learning something. You know, I actually learned something going to meetings listening, you know, even with that closed mind. And I was having trouble with the third step. I knew I was powerless over alcohol, you know. I wasn't sure about my life being unmanageable. I thought when I came in here, I was a pretty good guy, and if I stopped drinking, everything was going to be fine, you know. And that's what was driving me crazy, 6 months in AA, not drinking. My life was unmanageable, and I didn't realize it. I thought if I stopped drinking, I'd be in on the magazine or something. I don't know. And so when he says spiritual life is not a theory, we have to live it. You know, I start going, okay, I know I'm powerless. I know I'm insane when it comes to alcohol. And I've been to enough meetings where I heard people who are insane with alcohol like me, can't stop drinking, all saying the same thing. That they had found a power greater than themselves, and they stopped drinking. And they seemed to be happy about it. So I started believing that there was a God, in my understanding, that could keep me from drinking. It worked for you all, so I figured it might work for me. But the third step's where I had a problem. You know, I read it, you know, made that decision and everything, and I went to meetings, and people were talking about turning it over. I'll be honest, I was home in bed trying to turn it over like this. You know, I don't know what you mean by turn it over. I remember going up to a guy after a meeting, he says, what do you mean by turning it over? He goes, you know, turn it over. So I knew he didn't know what he's talking about either. You know? I was all confused about that. And what happened that night, I realized for me, what I had to do, I had to make a decision to try to live a spiritual life. I made a decision to try to align my will with the God of my understanding. Now, I'm not talking about going down to the airport and selling flowers, but trying to live my life with the God of my understanding, try to align my will. I can't give my will to God. He gave me free will. I doubt if He's going to take it back. You know? But what I can do with my free will is try to align it with the God of my understanding. And I made that decision that night. It was a Sunday night. It was an 8:30 meeting. I got home about 10 o'clock. I read this and made that decision. At 10:30, I pulled out a piece of paper and started writing a list of all the communists that are on my four-step. All the resentments I had and everything. It took me an hour and a half to do the four-step, and that includes breaks. Missed a lot of things. Made a lot of mistakes. But I made a beginning. So I had this four-step, took me an hour and a half. And, of course, I couldn't let the Washington Post get a hold of it, you know. Sort of embarrassing, and, you know, I was still full of fear and everything. Hey, I made that decision to try to live a spiritual life. Doesn't mean I was living one. I've just made that decision. So I called up a friend in Gaithersburg. Didn't call my sponsor, called a friend in Gaithersburg. Told him I wanted to share my four-step with him. You know, I wanted to keep it secretly. There was no secrets in my four-step, but for some reason I wanted to keep it to myself. I didn't want anybody to know, too embarrassed or anything. So I went up to see him. I shared my fifth step with him, and I lied to him. I lied to him. And I had good reason to lie. I was afraid of what he was going to think about me. You know? So I'm driving home, and I realize what I did. I lied to him because I was afraid. And all of a sudden that idea of self-centeredness, I finally knew what they meant. I remember sitting in meetings and the topic was self-centered fear and everybody seemed to have it, so I figured I had some too. You know? But this is the first time I could actually really see it. You know? So this small list I had in my four-step, I started looking at it a little closer. The self-centered fear. And start learning something about myself. I had a girlfriend written down. You know? And I wrote down, you know, how badly I treated her and all this stuff, you know? And how guilty I should be and all like that. And, you know, guy asked me, how do you really feel? And to be honest, I really feel like I'm... All that stuff was probably true, but I really felt like I was just sorry I lost her. There was no real concern for her. You know? And that really opened my eyes to what I was. You know? If we ever have a candy bar, break it in half. You better make it in the middle, because I'll take the biggest half. You know? And I never realized how self-centered fear ruled my life. You know? And I look back at my history, you know. I remember in high school I got in a fight with a guy I didn't want to fight because I knew he was going to kick my butt. But I had to fight him because everybody else wanted me to. It was the fear of what they would think if I didn't do it. And he did kick my butt. So I started seeing this, and then these names I got written down, I started seeing them. And the one thing I did on this fourth step, I wrote down the name, why they're on the list, how it affected me, and the last thing I wrote down was, how would the God of my understanding want me to act or feel? You know, and I started looking at that. And one thing I realized about feelings is I had a hard time with this in meetings. Everybody's talking about how they feel all the time. You know, and I was waiting for my feelings to change by coming to AA. You know, and they weren't. Like I say, for 6 months, I started going crazy inside. You know, and I went up to Billy and I was telling him this. And Billy says, I don't care how you feel. I care how you act. Act right and then we'll talk about your feelings. You know. And one thing I discovered about my feelings, I have no control over them. They just happen. But for some reason, by coming to AA, it seems like I have a little bit of time before I act on my feelings. And I can think of what I'm doing. Before, my history is all, the way I felt is the way I acted. And what I found is in AA, it was asking me to do something else. Now, when I got a problem today, what I do is I ask myself, how would the God of my understanding want me to handle this? And when I think I know, I usually call someone and talk to them first, you know, to see if I'm really headed in the right line. Because it's real easy for me to give myself the advantage, you know. So I went back and shared this fifth step with this guy, you know, and talked to him at the list. And I'll be honest, I've never done another fourth step. But I've never stopped taking one either. I have never stopped taking an inventory, you know. I missed a lot of names in the beginning, and I keep adding them on, you know. Something bothers me, I write the name down. I do the same thing I've always done, you know. I see why they're on the paper, how it affects me, and how the God of my understanding would want me to act and feel. Yeah. My feelings have never quite lined up with God's yet, to be honest. But it tells me how I should act, you know. I don't worry about how I feel about something so much as I worry about how I act, and then I work on the feelings. And I find the funny thing is when I act right, the feelings seem to fall in line. Yeah. The sixth step, entirely ready. Well, when I first read that, I go, well, Bobby's entirely ready to do this. You know? And what I found, Bobby can't do this. It's entirely ready to have God remove these defects of character. You know? And here's me again. You know, it's funny. I'm like the guy asking for help from God. And as soon as I get the help, I go, never mind, I'll take it from here. You know? All the time like that. So, right. Seventh step I think is fantastic. You know? If you know, I heard this, and this really helped me a lot. If I wait to get humble to use the seventh step, I'll never do it. Never do it. You know? So when I find these character defects, I ask God to remove them, and the most important action I can take, I act as if He has. Yeah, I act as if He has. You know, and all the stuff I'm doing, I have to talk to someone in AA. And something else my sponsor said, make sure you know who you're talking to. I have some friends of mine, no matter what I said, they'll say, you're right, she was wrong. You know, I got to pick the person I'm going to talk to and be honest with me. You know, and that's pretty easy to do. You come to a few meetings, you'll know who to talk to, you know, who you can share things with. And that's what I do, you know. Amends were great. I remember a lot of these things I didn't do in order. A lot of mistakes I made. My first amend was this old girlfriend, you know. And it wasn't to correct the past, it was to get her back. Yeah, I ain't stupid. It's like when I first prayed not to drink. I said, God, don't let me drink. It's working. So I started praying for money and sex. You know, I'm not stupid. God didn't let me drink. You know. So my first man was this girl. I was hoping to get her back. It didn't work. And the great thing I found out about making a direct amend is when you do it wrong, you know it. I learned from that, you know. So I started having this list of people I had to make amends to. You know, and a lot of them were financial. Yeah, and Billy was, you know, I talked to my sponsor, and at the time I had no money at all. And I wanted to make amends to someone I owed some money for. And Billy says, "You're not ready. What are you going to do? Say, I'm sorry, I owe you money?" He said, "An amend is giving him money." Billy told me an amend was like you had to, if you break a lamp, it's to replace it or fix it, not tell people you're sorry you broke it. You know? So in time, there's some amends I could make, and some I had to wait until I was financially ready. But I found when I made the amends for the right reason, I knew it. Something inside me changed, you know? And like I say, I've only taken one fourth step. And our 10 steps is we continue to take inventory. And I have. If something bothers me, I put the name down on a piece of paper. Why they're there. Sometimes I don't use paper. But I've gone through the process. I think the most important thing about the fourth step is learning how to take an inventory. Because to be honest, when I was in the Wheaton Tavern drunk as a skunk, the only inventory I ever took was the person next to me. I never took my own. And the idea that I'm going to take an inventory and do it right the first time? I've never done anything right the first time. I had to practice this stuff, you know? So the 10th step, I'm constantly taking inventory of things that happen to me. I still step on toes by mistake sometimes. I still make a lot of mistakes, you know? And the funny thing is, the same thing I discovered in the 4th step, that self-centered fear, is what I discovered in the 10th, you know? But sometimes we call it pride and jealousy, but it all comes down to self-centered fear for me, you know. Oh, one thing I want to tell you about the 7th step that happened to me, it worked. I had this girl that I started dating in AA. At the time I had 2 years of sobriety, and she had about a year and a half or something, and we dated a little bit, got along great, and all of a sudden it broke up. No bad feelings or anything. And all of a sudden, about 3-4 months later, she's with this guy, and I'm getting jealous. And as soon as I got jealous, I got on my knees that night. I asked God to remove the jealousy, and he did. He's never done that for anything else I've asked. He did do that for that, you know? Yeah, I find, you know, sometimes I'm willing, God's slow. Yeah. But I have to look at what I'm doing all the time. So in the 10th step, I constantly take this inventory, you know. And for me, the 10th step is really practicing 4 through 9, you know. And I find a lot of times being right, I'm wrong for the way I act, you know. I have a big problem, too, with self-righteous anger, you know. I'm right about things, you know. I love that, you know. I know exactly how you all should live. And I've got to watch that, you know. It's another form of self-centeredness I suffer from. Prayer and meditation is something I practice. And I remember when my spots told me I could start practicing right away, start praying, you know, because I was praying for money and sex already, you know. But meditation, you know, in the 12 and 12, I started reading that, and they had a prayer, the prayer of St. Francis. And I'd read that real slow and think of what each word meant. I started doing that every night, you know, and usually I'd fall asleep. So after about a week of doing this, I stopped doing it. And Billy, my sponsor, says, "You're still meditating." I went, no, it doesn't work. And he said, "I don't care if it works or not. Just keep doing it. Practice it." You know, and Billy started giving me this idea, these 12 steps aren't something you wear on your arm. You know, I'm a step 4, so you get 4 marks here or something like that. He started talking about practicing this program. You know? He says, "I don't care if it works or not, just practice it." I start practicing, and every once in a while something happens. You know? I find one thing about meditation, it used to be when my mind spins, that's all of a spin for some reason. You know? And I used to get off work or wherever, a few drinks and I slow down the spinning. Well, now I don't drink, so I don't have anything to stop the spinning. And what I find works for me is meditation. Yeah. Also, if I come to an AA meeting and listen, I can stop the spinning, you know. But my mind gets going real quick, you know, and it just gets going, so I just drive meditation, you know. And it's funny, while I'm meditating, it's amazing. I'm saying this prayer real slow and thinking about what each word means, and all of a sudden stuff goes through my mind like, I wonder if the car needs gas, you know. I wonder if this or that. And God says, don't worry about it, just keep doing it, you know. And what I find, those thoughts still go through my mind at times, but I'm getting better at it. And I've actually learned how to stop that spinning that goes on in my head, you know, by practicing prayer and meditation. My prayers have changed. I gave up on sex and money. Now I'm praying for what I have, you know. It's just, you know, it's just amazing. I didn't decide to change my prayers. It just happened, you know. At night, also, I find out I'm praying, you know. Have you ever prayed for eyesight? How amazing that is. I don't know where that thought came to me one night. I'm sitting there thanking God for my sobriety. And then all of a sudden I'm thanking Him for my eyesight. And for the first time I start thinking about eyesight, you know. Maybe I'm more insane than just alcohol. I don't know. And hearing and touch and life itself. You know, all, for some reason that night I was just filled with gratitude. My prayers have changed. I'm thanking God for the many things He's done for me, you know. Yeah. Our 12 step, I love that, you know. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, you know, we try to carry this message to the alcoholic and practice these principles in all our affairs. I think what's so amazing about the 12 step, it's a promise, you know. I've gone to meetings where they talk about the promises after the 9th step. There's 12 promises after the 9th, and they read them and everything like that. And all 12 are about losing self-centeredness, if you think about it. But there's promises all through the big book, you know. And it is probably the greatest promise we have. It tells me, if I'm willing to try to practice the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous in my life, that I'll have a spiritual awakening, you know. And a guy, you know, what's a spiritual awakening? I wondered that when I came in. You know, am I going to get all spiritual and crap or what? You know, I had no idea. You know, and what I've discovered for myself, a spiritual awakening for me, is for some reason my values have changed. Things that used to seem important aren't so important anymore. Also, I can feel one way and act another. I've never been able to do that. Now, I don't know if that's a spiritual awakening or what, but that's something different for me, you know. And so, for some reason, by practicing these steps, I think differently than I used to. I act differently than I used to. My values are different, you know. And what's crazy is I didn't decide for that to happen. That just happened. And that's the only way I could say it. It just happened by practicing the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know? It says we carry this message. Well, I can talk to you all about getting drunk at TikTok, and most of you can relate. You know? And I can talk about the blackouts I had, or when I was in the military, and I got busted one time because I was at the Pink Pussycat, which was off limits. It's a place for military men in Fort Bragg, but it's off limits. I got caught there, got knocked in the head and everything, you know. A lot of you can relate to that, or getting pulled over for drunk driving. Right, that's good to relate to that. But if I want to help you, I have to tell you what I did. And what I've discovered, my spiritual awakening, is from practicing the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it's the fellowship is fantastic. It's great, you know. But I don't think the fellowship alone would have gotten me sober. For 6 months, I tried the fellowship. You know, I was thanking everybody for sharing and telling everybody how I felt and making coffee. And all that's good. And I learned a lot. You know, it's part of the way I got sober. But that alone, I don't think would have kept me sober. I think what the difference is when Ben said, well, you ought to try our program. And that's the message I have for anybody that wants to stop drinking. Because that's what happened to me. I decided to try our program. It's written in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And my life changed. You know? And practice these principles in all our affairs. That's what I'm working on. You know? I'm working on that, you know? I'm practicing that. You know? And sometimes it's hard because I hang around a lot of people in AA. Sponsoring other people. Working with other people. You know? Can't think of anything greater. It's funny when I sit down with someone and tell them, talk to them about the practicing the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, there's no better way to look at a fourth step that I've done, review what I've done, but other than sharing with someone else what I've done to show them how I've done it. You know? For some reason, when I talk to someone about prayer and meditation that I'm working with, sponsoring, it makes me look, am I doing it? You know, my sponsor's real big. He says, someone tells you what to do, don't listen to them. If they tell you what they did, listen. You know, and I find that's real helpful for me when I come to meetings. When someone tells me what they do, I can listen. You know? And so what I found, if I want to carry this message, I tell them what I did and how I did it. The mistakes I made. The problems I had, you know. I think it's important. The problem I had with the third step. You know, I thought I was going to get it automatically. Just sitting there waiting and it didn't happen. I had to make a decision. You know. So I find working with others. Also, I believe AA is an upside down pyramid. The guys I sponsor, they call up with a problem before they can tell it to me. I said, wait a minute. I want them to listen to my problem first. You know, I told them if they want to solve their problem, talk to them. You know, I find it's just great working with other people. For some reason, something happens to me. You know, I've worked with a lot of people. A lot of them gotten drunk. You know, but I found no matter what happens to them, if I tell them what I've done and how I try to practice with what's in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I seem to get a little better. I seem to get a little better. Yeah. I have a group of guys I hang with. We go down on a trip down south, play golf. There's eight of us, seven of us in the fellowship. They all got 20 years or so, you know. And the most excited guy we have is a new one that comes down with us. Yeah. For some reason, when there's someone new in a room, it just picks up the room, you know. Gives me a chance to listen. And that's one thing else I learned, how to listen. My sponsor was great. He told me the best key I ever heard about sponsorship. I went with him with this huge problem. I said, Billy, what am I going to do? And Billy goes, I don't know. Let's go to a meeting. And that was his answer. Because he didn't know. So I use that all the time with people I sponsor. They give me questions and problems. I go, I don't know. Let's go to a meeting. You know. But for some reason, we don't drink. You know. So I can't say enough about sponsorship and working with others. I find that it helps, it renews what I'm doing. It makes me look at what I'm doing and how important that is. And the gifts AA has given me, the greatest gift of all, is I got a God of my understanding. When I came here, I was desperate. I wouldn't say I had any faith at all. The longer I've been here, the stronger my beliefs have become. I have a God of my understanding. I have a belief that I never had before. You know, and a lot of this, it wasn't like I made a decision to be this way. It wasn't like these things just happen. And I believe they happen by practicing the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sponsor also said one thing else to me that I should remember. He says, you're not going to get sober by sharing, you get sober by listening. So thank you all very much for listening.